Bibles open to Luke chapter 21. For a couple years now, our youngest daughter, Katie, has been obsessed with time. I don't know if you've seen this in her, but she always wants to know how long everything is going to be. She wants to know how long until the next thing that we do. She wants to know how long until we're going to get somewhere, how long until people are coming over. When she takes a nap, she always wants to know what number she can wake up at. She's funny. She can't tell time. And she doesn't have any sense of like what time it is or how long like time takes, but she always asks. And so she asks these questions, and Jane and I don't really know how to answer her in ways that satisfy her. So she keeps asking, you know, different versions of it. So a typical conversation between us as we drive to the park sounds something like, "Dad, when are we gonna be there?" "We'll be there at 11, sweetie." "So how long is that?" "I don't know, like 10 minutes. "So are we close?" "Yes, we're pretty close." A minute goes by, maybe, if she gives me that long. "Are we almost there yet?" "Yep, we're almost there." "About how long?" "About 3 minutes." "Dad, I see the purple house. We're almost there." "Yep, we're almost there." Pretty much daily, that's the conversation as we head to the park. And her obsession with time is just fascinating to me. I honestly don't fully understand it. And I always have the feeling that there's something about the way that she experiences time that doesn't quite connect with the ways that we tell time, right? Like our numbers, just, she's like, "I don't get those. Tell me time a different way." So I'm thinking about getting a sundial maybe. But I share this because Katie's this kind of constant reminder to me that time is sort of weird. Like the ways that we tell time, the ways that we understand time, it's weird because we are present and alive for like so little time, right? Time has been unfolding since the very beginning for so long before we ever showed up here. And time will continue to go on when we are gone and, sorry to tell you, forgotten. And with just like just the slightest movements of like planets and their orbits, like the way that we tell time, like the amount of time that we experience each day, like, could change dramatically, right? This is weird. And it's also a little bit wild. And I say this all because the Jewish people who we journey with through the scriptures, these are a time-telling people. And they didn't just know how to tell time, but they knew and they experienced the holiness, the sacredness of time. And they did this in part by marking out the passing of time with fasts and feasts. So they remembered past times through these holy days that helped them relive and re-experience, remember time that has long been gone. And this is part of what we do in this tradition, in this spirit, as we celebrate Palm Sunday. As we remember Jesus' entry into Jerusalem, we reflect on it in order to relive, to sort of inhabit that event in some way that helps us understand it. But for the Jewish people, these same holy days didn't just look back to the past, but they had a way of looking forward to something that was still to come, to time that still was yet to get to. And so it would help them to anticipate and expect a promised future. Our passage this morning is filled with time markers. There are these questions and conflicts over time. There are misunderstandings about time. There is the denial of time. And in the midst of all of this, there is the fulfillment of time. Jesus, again and again, through the Gospel of Luke, has been telling his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, that there in Jerusalem, the Son of Man would be rejected and he would be killed, and on the third day he would be raised again. And this is all coming to pass in him in this time. He is fulfilling time. But I want to start this morning near the end of our passage in chapter 21. Jesus and his disciples are surrounded by crowds. And they're in the temple. And Jesus has been in the temple since he came in, and he's been teaching the people, and we're told that he's been preaching the good news. And we pick up in verse 5. And we read, "While some were speaking of the temple, how it was adorned with noble stones and offerings, Jesus said, 'As for these things that you see, the days will come when there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down.'" So this is like maybe one of the most straightforward conversations that Jesus ever engages in. People are talking about the temple, and so Jesus responds by talking about the temple, and it's this temple that these people are fawning over. And he just says, its days are numbered. It will be torn down stone by stone, he says. This creates some interesting questions for his disciples, which we hear then in verse 7. So his disciples asked them, "Teacher, when will these things be? And what will be the sign when these things are about to take place?" The disciples are confused. Like, they're seriously confused. Because the destruction of the temple being torn down stone by stone, that was their past. I mean, the Jews had an entire holy day, set apart where they fasted and where they cried together as they remembered the terrible destruction of the temple, torn apart stone by stone so many years earlier. What could Jesus be talking about? And where does this event fit into the future, they wonder? For as divided as the Jewish people were over the details of the future, they had a couple pillars, or at least like keys, to understanding the future, sort of pillars that were important for the hope that they had. So that even if they disagreed with each other about how exactly it was all going to work out or when, they at least had some shared agreement in these areas. And the first of these areas was that they knew that they were supposed to be back in the land. This land that God had given them, they were exiled from, and they were supposed to be back. And when we get to the Gospels, here they are. They are back, and they've been back for several hundred years. So this is a good sign for future hope. But second, they knew the temple was supposed to be restored. And so the destruction of the temple had been the central sign that God had given them over to judgment, that God had given them over to Babylon. They knew that God was involved in this because God let the temple be destroyed. And the prophets, they spoke of a restored temple. And here, Jesus is speaking in it. So there's this sort of second piece that seems to have been fulfilled for them. Third, the people were looking for the visible presence of God to return to Jerusalem. The way the prophets tell the story, that when things got bad enough, the visible presence of God that had dwelled in the temple departed from Jerusalem. And it was only at that point that the temple could be destroyed, that Jerusalem could be destroyed. And so just as God had come and dwelled in this temple that Solomon had built so many years earlier, they hoped and believed that God would dwell in the restored temple. But it's interesting, in the first century, the time when Jesus is here and he's standing here in the temple, there were actually a lot of questions and debates and concern about whether God's presence had ever actually returned at all. And then there was a fourth key or pillar for them. The people were looking for Israel as a nation, a kingdom, to be reestablished as a sovereign people, right? Ever since exile, ever since the Israelites had been taken out of their land, they'd been under control of multiple superpowers. And so first it was the Babylonians, and then next it was the Persians, and then it was the Greeks, and then finally it was the Romans, and they're still under Roman occupation. And it was clear to Israel that as long as they were under the control of pagan Gentile people, that their redemption had yet to come. So land, temple, the presence of God, and kingdom, these were the pillars of Israel's hope. Land and temple had been fulfilled. It was debated as to whether the presence of God had returned, and the kingdom had certainly not come. But here the disciples are with Jesus. And just days earlier, Jesus had come into Jerusalem, as we read earlier, as part of this royal procession. Jesus had been received as King of Israel, and the pieces are falling together. And now Jesus is speaking of the destruction of the temple. We're like, what? When, Jesus? How can God's presence return if there is no temple? Like, can you see why this is so confusing and so disorienting for the disciples? Think of guys like Harold Camping, who just a few years ago were announcing an actual date for the end of the world. What do you do when that date comes and goes? And there the world is, spinning on its axis just as it did every day before. I don't know if you read much about it or kept up on it or whatever, remember it, but when the date arrived, the date for an event called the rapture, when Harold Camping and the faithful were supposed to be taken up and taken out of here to some otherworldly paradise, when it came and went, Camping began to review his materials. He went back and he reworked his calculations. He reconfigured his system. And then he announced he had the date wrong all along. So here's the new date. It's time to get ready. Who's coming with me? He said. Apparently nobody, because he's not going anywhere, or wasn't. He died since then, so, oops. But that date came and went as well. And again, the world has continued to spin. And Camping and his friends, they continued to live in it. Right? If you can call what they were doing, looking for that next date, recalculating, if you can call that living. Camping is the perfect example of how people react to being wrong. Behavioral psychologists have observed that people will rarely change their fundamental belief system. At least not in big, sort of substantial or major ways. So that what people do is take new information and rework their current belief system until they feel like they're compatible and that now they're right. for camping, that meant that he took this new information that he got, which is that his prior date was wrong, and he reworked his math. Once he was then convinced that the math added up, he announced his new date. I want to make sure that we understand that camping is not just some religious whack job. That basically camping is a like real and normal person. That behavioral psychologists are confirming all the time that this is normal behavior that most people exhibit in the way that we adapt to being wrong. So that even when a person discovers, maybe for the first time, that Jesus might be missing or might be the missing part of their lives, if they're like most people, they simply add Jesus to their current belief system. And so they remain politically conservative or liberal. They maintain their same prejudices. They maintain their same life goals. They even hang on to the ideas that they've always had about heaven and hell. They just add Jesus. Jesus now helps them live without guilt over their sin and gives real hope for the future. This is part of the reason why so many Christians often look so little like Jesus. We even tweak our belief system to explain why we don't need to look more like Jesus. Right? Even though Jesus says, "Be holy as your Father in heaven is holy," we immediately justify our lack of holiness by saying things like, "Yeah, but Jesus doesn't expect us to be perfect, so I'm doing okay." This is the goal and the purpose of discipleship. Making followers of Jesus who think and who love and who live more like Jesus, transforming the minds and the desires and the lives of people so that they look more and more like Jesus is the goal. This is what we are involved in. But here in Luke 21, just before Jesus is about to suffer and die, the disciples who have spent years with Jesus reveal that they still do not see time the way that Jesus sees time. They have been listening to Jesus for years. They have been listening to him teach the crowds and then turn to them and say, "Okay, let me explain this really clearly for you." And they've been taking in this new information and simply squeezing it into their old view of the world. That is the information makes sense and can be fit into their system. They accept and they sort of move forward. But the new information that doesn't fit, it simply gets discarded or ignored altogether. So that when Jesus tells them that the temple is going to be destroyed, they want to know when. Because technically, like, they could fit that into their view of the future, right? As long as it's like hundreds or thousands of years in the future, like, okay, cool. Jesus, that's fine. You can destroy the temple and I'm totally good with that. Like, I can still make sense of the world. But if that's gonna happen anytime soon, then my hopes for like a restored kingdom, my hope for like peace, prosperity, like, I just, these don't really work together. So when, Jesus, when is this gonna happen? But Jesus wants to break their hopes. Not because he's a jerk, but because he wants to give them new hope. Because he wants to give them better hope and truer hope, and to get them to turn from and leave behind false hope. Their hope has never been in the temple. He wants to dismantle for them their view of the world and their view of the future, and he wants to rebuild for them a better vision. And for Jesus, time matters. How you tell time, how you understand what has happened, what is going on now, what's happening in the future, this all matters. And as Jesus came into the city of Jerusalem, as you read it this week during using the daily worship guide, you heard he comes into the city and he begins to weep because they did not know the time. They did not recognize the time that it was. And he seemed to think that they should. The worst part about them not recognizing the time is that this was a pretty pivotal time in God's promises for the future. As Jesus comes into Jerusalem, this is the moment when the presence of God enters the city. This is the moment when the presence of God returns to Israel. And God's people were not prepared for this. They weren't ready. And like Harold Camping, they were wrong about the time. And this includes the disciples. Yet, like Camping, the temptation was there to just tweak the numbers in the formula in order to fix the date, right? To get the date right. What was important for the disciples is, Jesus, tell us when this will all take place so we can get the date right. But what if, like the disciples, Camping was working with the wrong formula? What if he was looking for the wrong thing? What if his entire equation was built around the wrong focus? Camping's idea that at a particular moment in time, God intends to pull his people out of the world. This event that some people have called the rapture of the church. What if Camping actually went back and reconsidered whether this idea actually has any place in God's plans for the future? Like, what if Camping didn't just tweak his vision of the future, but let God's word give him an entirely new vision? Camping faced the same problem the disciples and Jews of Jesus' day faced. This is what Jesus is doing with the disciples. See, because for them, and also for Camping, the temple, or for Camping, the rapture, is at the heart of God's plan for his people. And this isn't necessarily their fault. For Israel, over however many centuries, the temple had become more and more dominant as a symbol and as a source of hope. You can see this for us in our culture in the ways in which particular places, particular parts of our life together grow in their importance, right? There was a time when football stadiums were not what they are today, right, in terms of their overwhelming presence and passion. And these have become growing in importance in our culture. In the same way, the temple increasingly over time became this dominant and orienting presence and source of hope for the people. They saw it as a reminder that God was fulfilling his promises. And Jesus comes along and he quickly just goes, nah, it's going to be destroyed. Ah! But no, this... In verse 20, Jesus begins to describe the coming destruction of this temple. And one of the things that he says is it's going to be terrible for those who witness it. But it's going to happen. It's just part of what's coming. Worse, they learn in verse 24 that Zion, this holy city of God, Jerusalem... It's not just that it's going to be destroyed, that would be bad enough, but it is going to be trampled underfoot by Gentiles. Like, that's the worst kind of defeat, right? It's like getting beat by your mortal enemy. It's like getting beat by the most embarrassing, shameful opponent ever. You don't want to get beat by the Gentiles, and this is what's happening. God's holy dwelling place is going to get trampled under feet by Gentiles. And so what Jesus is telling them is that the very worst, most horrific moment in their past, the thing, the event that defined the Jews for hundreds of years, that God was just going to let it happen to them again. And so that once again, Israel would be without a temple. That once again, Gentiles would have victory over Israel. I mean, it's really hard to capture just how disorienting this would be. This doesn't even come close, but as I was trying to think of an analogy, it might be like somebody telling us that we were going to have another bloody civil war, and that at the end of it, we would return to a place where women didn't vote and where we owned slaves because of the color of their skin, right? Like, that's, no, we can't go back there, right? There's no going back to that. That disorients us. And what Jesus is announcing is this devastating loss of everything Israel had regained since their exile in Babylon: land, temple, the presence of God, and the kingdom. See, Israel was supposed to regain these things, not lose them again, they thought. But maybe you can already sense part of the problem. The temple. The temple was and had only ever been about one thing: the presence of God. Right? The temple was the place where God had dwelled among his people. And so the temple was never intended to be a main thing for them. In fact, when David comes and asks God if he can build him a house like this, God made it clear that this was not God's plan or his purpose. But here in Israel, the temple had become the main thing. And you can hear it in the conversation that Jesus overhears from these people that are just in awe of its majesty and its beauty. And as these people are standing in adoration of the stones and of the beauty, they are busy missing the truly beautiful one that is in the midst of them. The presence of God, like walking among them in a temple of flesh. Jesus is largely ignored or misunderstood by those who adore a building. Or worse, Israel's leaders, they want to tear this temple of flesh down to the ground. Jesus announces that their building of stone is going to come down, and they're concerned when in their midst is the dwelling place of God, Jesus, who is going to be destroyed. The disciples wrongly have the temple at the heart of their hopes for the future. In much the same way that Harold Camping has this thing, this event called the rapture, at the heart of his hopes for the future. See, the temple took the Israelites' gaze and redirected it so that they missed what God was doing as he walked among them. And I think the rapture has often taken the gaze of God's people and redirected it so that we miss what God's Spirit is doing in the world. See, the rapture ultimately is about a God who takes his people out of the earth and takes them to a heavenly paradise where they can avoid the pain and destruction that is apparently coming to the earth. But it's interesting when we think about who God is and what God does all throughout the story of Scripture. God has only ever been about one thing: the complete restoration of his creation, not its destruction. The God that we worship, the God that has gathered us here in this place together to worship him, is a God who does not abandon his work, but a God who redeems it. A God who does not stay away from the mess, of humanity, but enters into it, taking flesh on himself. That God does not destroy his creation. He makes it new. This God doesn't smite his enemies. He dies for them, and he invites them to repent and find their life in him. And so we can be pretty confident that God does not pull his people out in order to hide them from evil and shield them from suffering. No, God fills his people with his spirit and then sends them to confront evil with love. God sends his people to live and to serve and to die like Jesus, giving our lives away because somehow this kind of love brings healing to the nations and to God's good creation. Jesus is committed to changing the disciples' understanding of the future, because the way they understand the future has something to do with the way that they live now. Whatever they thought about the way things were going to work out, it's not going to work like that, Jesus says. So in chapter 21, verse 10, Jesus describes nations rising against nations and kingdoms against kingdoms. And Jesus says, you know what? There are going to be earthquakes and there are going to be famines and diseases in the future. These are going to be part of life. This is what the future holds. Endure, Jesus commands his disciples. And he says, you will find life in endurance. But then Jesus makes it a little bit worse. Thanks, Jesus. He's so good at that in Luke. Because he focuses his attention not just on like the general experiences of everyone in the world, but he focuses on the experience of his disciples. And in verse 16, he wants them to understand, this is what it means for you to live in this world if you follow me. Parents and brothers and sisters and relatives and friends are going to turn you into the authorities, and you will be brought before kings and governors, and you will be persecuted. Amen. And yet it is so important for us to understand all of this, to hear Jesus say these things, so that on days like today, when we hear news of dozens of our brothers and sisters in Egypt being bombed as they gather to worship this morning, we are not surprised, for one, and so that our faith is not shaken, for another, because 2,000 years ago, Jesus told his disciples that this is the way things would go. This is the way the world works. When people give their lives over to all of the things that they trust that bring death and destruction. If we don't understand what Jesus has said about the world and the future, we will be like the disciples on the day the church is called Holy Saturday in our history and tradition. The disciples, the day after their king has been crucified, are now utterly lost, completely devastated, confused, disoriented. Their lives, their world, everything they have and thought they knew is upside down. If we forget that Jesus said this, that this will happen, we will live as though it's Holy Saturday, in despair, hiding. And this all might sound really dark, but Jesus finishes this speech in a really profound way. He draws on Daniel, the great visionary of Israel, to give his disciples a new vision. And we read in verse 25, Jesus saying, and there will be signs in sun and moon and stars and on the earth, distress of nations in perplexity because of the roaring of the sea and the waves, people fainting with fear and with foreboding of what is coming on the world. For the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Let me say this. Luke is going to go on in the next couple chapters to give us details about the sun's light failing and darkness falling on the land, essentially signs in the sun and the moon and the stars. Jesus is using these images from old visions to describe what is to come, to describe his death. It is the death of Jesus that shakes the power of the heavens. His resurrection, then, will unmask the power of the heavens. If death of all things in the world, of all things in our lives, if death cannot hold Jesus, the nations and kingdoms of the earth, they don't stand a chance against him. And Jesus continues in verse 27 when he says, "And then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory." Now, when these things begin to take place, straighten up and raise your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. Now, what Jesus is doing is he's taking Daniel's exact language of the Son of Man coming on the clouds to describe an act of power and of great glory and redemption. By doing this, what Jesus is saying is, listen, when earthquakes and famine and disease come, and if we pay attention to the news, these things are a constant part of life throughout the whole world and throughout history. When these things come, when nations rise and when kingdoms rise and when nations fall, that's not falling, fall and kingdoms fall, right? If you are in the midst of any of this stuff, the earth is going to feel like it's falling apart. When your loved ones hate you and turn against you because of Jesus, it is going to feel like your world is crumbling. And it will feel that way because these things are in many ways the aftershocks of Jesus' death. Every power in our lives, in our world, has been put on notice. The Son of Man has come to undo the curse, to set his people free. I just want you to hear maybe again the verse I read from Daniel earlier. Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. Daniel describes this vision he had in the night, and he says this: "Behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days, and he was presented to him. And to him, to the Son of Man, was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, so that all peoples, all nations, all languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom is one that shall not be destroyed." Jesus gives his disciples a new future to hold to. Now it's one that they cannot understand yet. And as you've finished Luke in your small group reading, you know what will come, that when Jesus is raised from the dead, their eyes will be opened and they will see. They will understand that this is the future God has been pointing them to all along. They will get it. When Jesus then leaves them, the book of Acts tells us in the first chapter that he will leave in a particular vehicle, a cloud. A cloud will take Jesus up and out of sight. This is not an accidental detail by the author of Acts. And the disciples are going to immediately understand what is happening. When Jesus disappears in a cloud, it's not a magic trick. It is the fulfillment of Daniel 7, that Jesus is going to the Father. And it's there in the Father's presence that the Father will give him authority over all of the earth, over every kingdom and over every throne. Every kingdom and throne and ruler and power and principality, all of them are under the reign and the authority of Jesus. Jesus seemed to believe that if his disciples could understand this, they would live in ways that transformed the world. See, the disciples, they thought that they had seen Jesus come into Jerusalem as the King of the Jews. And they thought that his primary mission was to restore Israel. Isn't it awesome how often we want to give Jesus such small plans? The reason Jesus doesn't need a temple is because Jesus' plans were way bigger than Israel. They involved Israel, no doubt. Israel is at the center and at the core of this story, but only as the beginning, only as the catalyst for what would come. Jesus' plan was much bigger, much broader, involved every tribe and tongue and nation, involved all of his creation. See, Jesus was preparing to die for the sins of Israel and also for the whole world. Jesus was preparing to take his throne, not just in Jerusalem, but at the right hand of the Ancient of Days. And what this means is that we truly do not have to fear the chaos of our world, because currently, today, at this moment, Jesus is King over all things. This is good news. Jesus isn't living in a temple made with human hands. Jesus has filled the earth with his spirit as he has filled his people, his church, with his spirit. And he has sent his church to every tribe and tongue and nation. And he has done this so that in every place where his spirit goes, God's good and loving and just rule can inhabit the earth and can transform people's lives as people hear this good news, this call to repent and to find our life in him, the one who gives life. So that in every tribe, in every tongue, and in every nation, Jesus shows up. And men and women like us. And if we will understand the time, that Jesus doesn't have a secret plan to snatch us out of this place when nobody's looking. If we will understand that Jesus' time is for us to be here in the midst of great suffering, to walk with those who suffer the way that he did, then maybe Jesus will be able to use us right here where we are to comfort those who are finding their hope in other places, to confront the evil kings and idols of our world with love and grace and sacrifice. Part of the reason the church lived out its Jewish heritage in being a time-telling people is that the ways that we tell time orient us to the ways that the world works. One of the things I discovered recently, which is fascinating, is that we tell time on a clock. Which way? Clockwise, right? That if you look at the way that the church has drawn the church year, it's also used a circle. Turns out circles are really helpful for things that keep happening. But guess which direction the church calendar goes? Yeah, we say backwards, but it's not backwards, it's rightwards. But the reason the church calendar goes counterclockwise is supposed to be a reminder that life in the kingdom of God will always grind against the rhythms of the world that we inhabit. That this is part of what it means to be Christian people. And so when we celebrate Palm Sunday, when we submit to the rhythms of Holy Week, and this week, if you will use the daily worship guide, you will find them taking us together through the stories that lead us to Jesus's death and resurrection. And Friday night, we'll gather together to remember and reflect on and experience that Friday that we have come to call good. And Sunday, we will celebrate the resurrection together. That this is part of learning to tell time the way God tells time. And that resurrection, every single Sunday, is about reminding us that we worship a very particular God. God raised Jesus from the dead in the same body that he died in. He restored and made new the body of the crucified Jesus. What this reminds us of is that when God makes us new, when God makes creation new, he doesn't scrap us and start over. But that to some extent, we will bear the marks and the wounds of this life. That we will be made new of the same raw materials. And the same is true for God's creation. That all of this is enfolded in this resurrection story, that God does not give up on us. God does not abandon us or throw us away, but God is busy making all things new. And so we come to the table this morning, reminded that there is a king who gave his life for us, and who invites us to come and to enjoy his fellowship and his presence, to receive anew today his sacrifice and his love, so that we might be made into people who are capable of offering this love to others.